Well, we're continuing our series today called The One Thing, and we're examining priorities together to see what is the one thing in our life and in our faith that is above all other things. So we went down to Pearl Street a couple weeks ago, and over the next few weeks, you're going to hear from just some members of our community about what they think about priorities in their life. So one question we asked them was to rank these three things: faith, family, and finances. And here's what they had to say.
Actually, I like that order: family, spiritual thing, finances. Love my family, spend tons of time with them. This is my sister, so yeah, so you know, love that. Spiritual things, because you know, what's the point of living if there's not anything else besides that? And then finances, because it's money. And money can only buy a certain amount of things, but not happiness. So, I mean, I know that sounds cliche and all, but.
Family, finances, faith. My wife is the most important person in my life. I have a lot of student loans to pay off. And, yeah, spirituality is what it is. And, I mean, it's here, so it's, you know, unavoidable.
Right now, I have finances, then family, then spirituality, probably.
Okay.
At least right at this moment. Lots of hospital bills.
Family, spiritual, financial.
I guess I would say it's kind of a tie between spiritual and financial, and then family.
Yeah.
Those three issues, well, financial is kind of, I mean, it is what it is, you know. But with spiritual issues and family issues, they're kind of, in my opinion, like fluid. Like, you can't really, they change, you know what I mean? Things aren't like this way and that way, and that's how they are. Like, things change over the course of a life. So, I don't know. That's why I guess I say that.
Family, spiritual.
Yeah, that's fine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, number one is?
Family.
Then spirituality.
And then finance.
Family is like your core, your priority, the center of everything. It kind of relates too, though, to like spirituality, because especially like as an adolescent, that's where you grow up learning about faith, I guess.
Yeah. I'm going to go with spiritual, faith things, God, family, finances, and everything else will come after that, I think. Well, I'm a Christian. I believe that God's number one over everything. Obviously, sometimes, unfortunately, I don't make him a priority as much as I should. But I believe if you follow him, he's going to make your family a lot better. He's going to make your finance life better, and all your things will come into place. So.
If you could rate family, faith, finance, how would you categorize and order your world? We're in a series called First Things, The One Thing. And how do you keep your priorities ordered well in the complexities of life? And in particular, as we look at the scriptures, we see over and over again those who were God followers and Christ followers use this kind of language: this one thing I do. Last week, this one thing I do, I forget the past. This morning we're going to look at the role that some God followers in the scriptures identified with regard to their family life and their relationship to God. And we're going to hold these things together. I was talking with a friend of mine this week who said he was convinced that the number one unmet felt need in America is the desire or the value to have better family relationships. If you press most people, even on Pearl Street Mall, what's the most important thing in your life? Over and over again, we heard on the video, though not exclusively, the most important thing is family. There's more demand for good family relationships and sort of less provision in the world for how does one accomplish good family relations. Today, people in our country spend more money on trying to acquire good family, healthy life relationships, on books, classes, seminars, counseling, drugs, therapy, group sessions, to get a better family, a better life, a, A bigger house will do it. A better car will do it. A bit more accumulated toys perhaps will increase the quality of our family life together. A better vacation, a nicer place, higher education. You know, you describe where are people spending their money in order to get what? Ultimately, I think the longing in the hearts of many people is to get better relationships, and particularly as they relate to their personal relationships and family. On the same hand, people worry more about family relationships, about their relationships with kids, parents who are aging, concern, sleepless nights, anxiety, tears, arguments, discussions. You think about your family life, and more energy is sort of put into how do I acquire a great family life. The family is a gift from God, but it is also a tremendous challenge at times, isn't it? That would be a good place to say yes. Yeah, there are some real challenges. Today, there is more family dysfunction than at any other time. I wonder if that's true. I wonder if we looked at the Bible examples of family, whether we'd see any dysfunction. Think we would? Hey, parenthetically for a moment, let me tell you that in the last week, we have had the opportunity as a nation to get a glimpse at a pop culture family and to observe from this distance the value set assigned to a family in our culture. If you happen to have been with us a number of weeks ago when we talked about standing strong in the culture, the very last message in that series was standing strong in the face of spiritual blindness. And I hope every family member in this room was observing this week. You had the opportunity in our culture to observe a profound series of spiritual blindness signals that were going on through the observance of the funeral that happened this week. Absent are concepts that are biblically defined as sin and righteousness. Absent is the reality of eternity that happens at any moment. I was very concerned as I watched how absolutely vacated was any thought of the reality of stepping out of this life and in the next moment being in eternity and having to face God. I assure you, Michael Jackson is not on a crescent moon somewhere. Okay? I just want to direct all dads and moms here that as you have these cultural opportunities to see value systems and values present all over the place, this is your moment to sort of take your kids and grandkids along and say, well, what does the Bible say about life and death and the moment after your life is over? What happens? Okay. That's not this morning's message. This morning's message, though, is family. And how do we have a healthy family? How do we grow strong in family? And frankly, the question today is, how do you keep God first in family? If there's family dysfunction all over, and we see it in the news, and frankly, we may see it in our own living rooms, we may see it in our own life, a little bit of dysfunctionality, yes? You say, well, wow, this is really a crazy time. I want to bless your heart this morning by looking at some biblical examples that may encourage you. I mean, let's start with a minute in Genesis. My name is Adam. I am the first man. I am the first man, and I messed up early in the garden. I had two sons. One was Cain, the other Abel. They didn't get along well. And my oldest son killed my second-born son. First family. Wow. Sometimes the Bible record of family dynamics is a little bit unsettling, isn't it? Fortunately, that's not the only one. Two chapters later, everything comes apart and God says, I've had enough. And a flood comes and he gathers Noah into the ark. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth and that every thought and every intent of the heart was evil continually. And so God said, do over. And so, you know, waters come and we start again. And in chapter 12 of Genesis, now 12 chapters into the Bible, Abraham is called by God. And he's called and he has a wife named Sarah. And Abraham is a strong husband, though not that strong. And he fears to obey God and he travels with his wife and he gives up his wife to Pharaoh for fear of his own life. A husband offers up his wife to Pharaoh to protect his life. That was disappointing. In case there are not enough problems, then Sarah is promised with Abraham to be the progenitors of a nation that's grand. But she's very old and she's infertile. And the issue of infertility in the first couple after the flood, Abraham and Sarah, is another major obstacle in family life. And if that's not enough, then a second time later on in the same book, Abraham again offers his wife as his sister to protect his life. But soon God answers the prayer of Abraham and his promise to Abraham and Sarah. And he says, all right, this time next year you're going to have a son. And Sarah, a woman of God full of faith, does what? She laughs out loud. Impossible. Wait a minute. This is Sarah and Abraham. She doesn't believe that God will do it. Also a little bit disappointing. But soon Isaac is born. And Isaac is then offered by Abraham up to the Lord. And suddenly, I hope you pay attention to the flow of biblical story. That God gives and then tests. And the faithful man of God receives and gives back to God, and God preserves. Isaac is offered, but not killed. And God provides a substitute, a beautiful foreshadowing of what God would do in his own son, Jesus Christ. But the storyline goes on. Abraham has this son, Isaac, and he marries Rebekah. And Isaac had two sons, Esau and Jacob, and they got along well. No, their relationship was filled with deceit and treachery, and the brothers have ongoing tension surrounding their relationship. And Isaac loves Esau, and Rebekah loves Jacob, and there's family tension in the relationship between who's the dad's favorite, who's the mom's favorite. And the two boys had very different personalities, very different giftings, very different interests, very different parental support and relationships. And you get a glimpse into this family and you say, wow, what's going on here? This doesn't seem quite right. And it isn't. It's a total conflict, and deceit and treachery follows them all the way through to the end. And it's Rebekah, the mother, who orchestrates a final conflict of her favorite son by deceiving her own husband, Isaac, by giving a deathbed blessing to Jacob, not Esau. I mean, you say, is there any dysfunction going on here? And suddenly you say, hey, honey, we're pretty normal. We're not that bad. Things aren't too bad for us. And you look at the Bible flow of things and you say, well, what comes next? Well, Jacob falls in love and he marries two sisters. And he has 12 sons, but he has a favorite, and his name is Joseph. And Joseph, oh, he's the prize of the family, and everybody loves Joseph so much. And these 12 brothers get along so well as a family that they finally said, I've had enough of you, young man, and your colorful coat. And they ship him off, and they put him in a pit, and they sell him. And you say, what is going on with this family? It's got to get better. So David, the king, comes, and David is going to be the man who's a man after God's heart, and he's going to have a good family life for us to model. And so he's out on the palace one night, and he looks down, and there she is. And she's bathing, and he calls her, and he takes her, and he violates her, and she becomes pregnant. And then he orchestrates the murder of her husband. The child dies. God judges David, and he says to David, "You're going to have turmoil in your family forever." David has children: Amnon, Tamar, Absalom. How do they do? Well, Amnon is so filled with lust that he violates his half-sister. Absalom is so mad at his half-brother, he kills him. Then he wants his father's throne, and he comes after his father. You say, this is King David and his family. Again, you say, honey, we're okay. You know, we're somewhat normal. What's going on here? I want you to know that the Bible story is God's way of dealing with broken, broken people. And the missing component I referred to earlier in this service that we didn't see in this cultural experience this week is that sin is no longer named for what it is and what it does and how it wrecks our lives. Basically, the story of broken people's lives and family disasters all come down to our own personal rebellion against God and how the tentacles of that rebellion infiltrate every relationship of husband to wife, wife to husband, parents to children, children to each other. And it goes so deep and wide, it's pervasive. And the only remedy that God has provided in this regard is to send his own son, his own family, on our behalf, that we would be brought right into relationship with him again. You look throughout the Bible, and you'll just see again and again how ruined lives are wrecked by sin and redeemed by God. And if your family is in trouble, I have a great deal of hope for you that you are the ones who follow in the line of those preceded us who trusted God, heard his voice, and stumbled along in belief and obedience, and God met them and helped them and redeemed them and blessed them and kept bringing them up to a new level of standing and living that was different than what they were before they knew him. And that's the hope I have for you and your family, for you and your house. Now, what I want to suggest to you is that it has always been God's work to reveal his word, to call people and families, whether you're single, you're married, you're divorced, you're widowed, you're a child, you're a grandparent, to put God first in your life. And that's how you put him first in your family. I just want to remind you that God is gracious. There are no perfect families. That would be a good time to say amen. There are no perfect families. Can I say there are no simple 1-2-3-step formulas for how it's going to work perfectly for you. Here's what there is. There is a very gracious, redeeming God who meets us in our brokenness and says, I will help you if you listen to me. God redemptively works in families and all people who follow him, even if you're alone or you're single or you're widowed. His answers are not always the same, but his love and grace are always the same. This is what God has said throughout history. From Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 4. Let's read this out loud together. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand They'll be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, so that in every experience of your life, you see the commands of God. This is how you put God first. This is God's lesson to Israel. This is the way in which God is first for you. If he will be first in your family, then you, as the member of that family, and if you say, well, my parents don't do that, you start. You be the young person who does that. I love the Lord, my God, with all of my heart, with all of my soul, with all of my strength, with all of my mind. That means I think well of God. My affections are for God. My energy is for God, so I serve him well in my life. And all of my strength is for God. And the commands that he gives, I obey. The commands of God are always before me. Now, we've described this at baby dedications as the way that in every experience of life, we have God in our mind. We have God in our view. And it is the role of every mom, every dad, and every Christ follower to say, how does God factor into this decision? How does God factor into our family? How do we see God as present in our present financial crisis, in our present medical prognosis, in the relational tension that we're experiencing? How does God fit into that in our family? When you put God first in family, then you say, okay, God, you have a word for this situation, and we want to listen to it. Because we're putting you first on our forehead, on our hand, on our gates, on the doors. You're everywhere. For you, it might be your refrigerator. It might be the mirror in your bathroom. It might be anywhere around your house where you say, this will help me think God first in our house. This is what Joshua said when he called all of the people of Israel. As they were getting ready to enter the land, he said, now therefore, you fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. You put away the other gods that your fathers served in Egypt, and you serve the Lord. And then this very famous call to all of Israel, if it seems desirable to you in your sight, you serve the Lord, but you choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your father served beyond the river or the Amorites in whose land you're living, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's our first call. And boy, this is where in our world, we need moms and dads who get up every morning and say these words. As for me and this house, we will serve the Lord. Hey, kids, we serve the Lord. That's why we don't go to that movie. Hey, kids, as for us, our family identity is God first. And this is the reason why we always do this, whether it's go to church. Could you tell your kids, this is the reason why every time I get a paycheck, I take part of it and I put it aside for my church. I want you to know what I do with our money, kids, because this is the way that I reinforce in my own heart and in our family that it's God first. And someday when you get older, you are going to have to choose for yourself who you're going to serve, and you're going to have lots of choices. You're going to have the same God I serve, and you're going to have the gods that everybody else serves. They're called money, sex, pleasure, and you're going to have a choice. And I want you to really consider serving God like I do. Wow. That's a family reformation. That's a life reformation. This is what we find from Sarah. From Hannah in the Old Testament, who said, there is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there's no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. If you have your Bible, let's open together to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel my introduction's over. let me illustrate from the life of a woman who faced great disappointment in her life. She had disappointment after family disappointment after family disappointment. And we learned something from her life on how she put God first. And I hope it will encourage you this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 1, there was a man named Elkanah. And Elkanah was married to two wives, which is also a problem. Hannah and Peninnah. Peninnah had children and Hannah did not have children. This man would go up every year to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord. He had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were the priests of the Lord there. And when Elkanah came and sacrificed, he would give a portion to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. Now, just a glimpse into the life of Hannah and her infertility, inability to have children, is a word about God's sovereignty in the midst of this that is spoken. Some in faith can receive this. I pray you can. The biblical record is that God was sovereign in the giving of children. They are a gift from the Lord. And for some unknown reason, her womb was closed so that she had no children. And it happened year after year. If she went to the house of the Lord, Peninnah would provoke Hannah. And so Hannah wept bitterly and she would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, said to Hannah, "Why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not better than 10 sons? This is where you say, "No, no, don't answer that. Don't answer that. Don't answer that." Hannah rose after eating. Eli was sitting in the temple. And she was greatly distressed, and she prayed to the Lord, and she wept, and she made a vow to the Lord. She said to the Lord, "If you indeed will look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor will never come to his head." There's a signal here about God first in Hannah's life. She makes a vow, kind of a bargain with God. "If you give me a son, I will give him back to you." And all I'll say here is that she sees God as the source of everything and simply says, "If you give me a son, he's yours." Many of us in this room have followed this biblical procedure and process in our own lives with our children. And I remind you what some of you may have said to the Lord about your sons and daughters who perhaps today are in a distant land. Could I remember what you said? "Lord, if you give us children, they'll belong to you. We give them to you." This was Hannah's God first moment. "If you give me a son, I will give him to you." And so it came about that as she was praying, Eli was watching her and her mouth was speaking, but no words were coming out. It was customary in this culture that if you prayed out loud, and she was making no noise, but mouth was moving. Eli confronted her, verse 14, "How long will you make yourself drunk? Put your wine away." She said, "No, Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have neither drunk wine nor strong drink. I've poured out my soul before the Lord." This is another signal of a God-first woman. "My soul is completely open to you, God. I want my life open. I pray before you. Here's the cry of my heart. I plead with you. My soul is open before the Lord." And she says, "Don't consider me worthless. I have not spoken out of my great concern and provocation." And Eli, the priest, said, "Go in peace, and may the Lord of Israel grant your petition." And she said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." And she went her way. Her face was no longer sad. And this is another God-first signal. She heard the priest, believed the word, went away believing. Okay, these are signals of a woman whose heart is the Lord and say, "God, you first in my life. I lament that I can't have children, and if you give me children, I will give him to you." She goes in, she prays and pours out her heart. And the priest thinks, she's drunk. No, I'm not. My heart is God's. And then she goes away believing, trusting God. And I believe we see a picture of her faith. And the Lord gives her a son. And Samuel is born to her. She weans Samuel. And then after just probably 2 or 3 years, verse 23, the husband, Elkanah, says to her, do what seems best, remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word. So the woman remained, nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, a jug of wine, brought him to the house of the Lord along with the child who was young. And they slaughtered the bull, brought the boy to Eli. She said, my Lord, as your soul lives, I'm the woman who stood beside you praying to the Lord. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given the petition I asked. I've dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he'll be dedicated to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there and apparently stayed there from age 3. Another God-first moment for this woman who said, okay, I said, he's yours. Can you imagine walking away from your 3-year-old, leaving him with Eli, who hadn't done very well with his own sons? And then she prays these beautiful words in chapter 2. My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly over my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one beside you. There is no rock like our God. Hey, I want to give you a couple options this morning. Your family has had some disappointing moments. Have you? Your life, maybe you're disappointed at how things came down. You have some options. One is to gripe against God. And I know some griping parents. Okay? I don't see that as a God-first response. I'll talk to the young people and the kids who are here. Your family is a little disappointing. Folks didn't measure out exactly the way you hoped they would. You have options. And we have biblical precedent. There is a prodigal son who says to his family, I've had enough of you, I'm out of here. And he leaves. The story that Jesus told. Let me give you a better option. What if in the midst of the disappointments of your life, even in your own family, you could say this, this disappointment in my life is simply a greater opportunity for me to see God in his sufficiency and provision. I will trust him and stay put. I mean, don't leave your marriage. I mean, stop messing around if you're messing around. I mean, stop rebelling against your parents and say instead against those disappointments, God, you are first, and therefore, I will endure this disappointment. And I will persevere, and I will trust in the midst of disappointment, seeing that it is an occasion for me to put my trust in you through an uncertainty and allow you to provide for me in your own special time. And in all of these things, in whatever disappointment that you face in your family, perhaps you could say this, Lord, I know that even though I am disappointed here and these things have not turned out the way I wanted, whether it's infertility or job loss or cancer or an uncertain future or the loss of all your money or you name it, and you say, this just hasn't worked out, I want to call you to say instead, God, there is no God like you. No rock like God. More than prudential. I mean, grab a piece of the rock and say, there is no God like you, and whatever happens in my life, in my family, to my wife, to my children, whatever happens, God, there is no God, like you. You first in me. You first in my family. Whatever happens. Can you say that? Let's pray together. You may hear the words of Jesus this morning saying to you, very profound. Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers or children or farms for my name's sake shall receive many times as much. God first. And that's what makes family great. And I pray today that your heart will rest in the rock who is greater than any life circumstance. Your heart will trust in the Lord whatever you're facing today. And you will say with Hannah, Lord, my life is yours. I pour out my soul to you. I trust in you and I believe. And I pray, oh Father, that you will be right in the presence of our view. On our hands, on our forehead, in the window, on the mirror. You'll be everywhere in our hearts and minds, and that we will trust in you and cling to your word, whatever circumstance we're in today, and that it will be our cry as families and people and as a church, God first. God first. For your glory, we pray. Amen.